What's Your Story is a program that discovers people in the Bay, really. The people that you might bump into in the street, you might know them by sight. You might know them by reputation. This is called What's Your Story, and it's an opportunity for people to talk about where they came from and how they got to be in the Bay. And tonight we have in the studio Naomi Halpern. Hi, Naomi.
Hi, Bob.
So are you Naomi or Naomi?
Naomi.
Naomi. Okay, we got that straight. And you've been in the Bay for quite a while.
Yes, I first got here in 1997. That's when I bought my place, but I've only been living here full time since 2011.
Okay, well, we usually start at the beginning. So, where were you born?
I was born in England, in a town called St Albans, which is about half an hour north of London. It's an old Roman city.
Okay. Big family?
No, not too big. I'm the youngest of three children.
Ah, the revolutionary.
That's right. The black sheep of the family.
Well, the youngest ones are meant to be, more so in bigger families, are meant to be the revolutionaries, so they say. And so growing up in the UK, went to school there?
Yes, so we lived in St Albans until I was 11 years old, and then the family moved up to the Midlands in Leicestershire to a small village called Market Bosworth, which, if you know your English history, is where the Battle of Bosworth Field was fought, and the famous line by King Richard, "A horse, a kingdom for my horse."
A kingdom for a horse.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they found his bones recently.
Indeed.
In Leicester City.
Right. So, is there anything that you remember particularly about that time, going to school and living there?
I remember, I'm moving from St Albans, and so I had a home county accent. And when I moved up to the Midlands, which was a very different accent,
people judge you
by the way that you speak. And so there was a lot of assumptions that because of the way I pronounce things, I said path instead of path and bus instead of buzz, that they thought I was a bit snobby. So it actually took quite a while for people to actually realise that, you know, no, I wasn't. I just spoke different.
And how old were you when this was going on?
I was 11.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So a bit challenging for you.
It was actually very challenging. So I had been expecting to go to a local grammar school in St Albans when I finished primary school. And you know, that was all being sort of geared up to. And then out of the blue, my father announced that he had changed his job. And so we were all going to be moving up to the Midlands. So it was a bit of a shock for all of us kids. We weren't really happy about it, you know, to start with. And I think it took us all a little while to sort of settle into, you know, a new area and make new friends.
And how did you go about that? Do you remember?
Oh, I was just my charming self.
Learning a different way to speak.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I had to do that again when I moved to Australia as well.
And so how long were you there? How long did you?
So we lived in Market Bosworth until I left school, and then I moved into Leicester City, and that's where I attended university.
Okay. So you didn't have a big desire to go to university in London or in Edinburgh, or was it just?
No, well, it's funny. When I applied for university, so I was applying to go to social work, and when I first made my application, I was actually in a relationship, and so I applied to go into the city where the relationship was. Of course, by the time university came along, that relationship had long gone, and so I regretted not taking one of the other choices where I'd also been accepted, but, you know. You live and learn.
So, well, you do indeed. And as a young teenager, before university and going to high school, were you Were you driven by a love of math or a love of sport or a love of a good time? I had a hatred
and an absolute fear and dread of maths. Mm. I remember at primary school we had a headmaster who was absolutely obsessed with maths. And when your teacher was away for whatever reason and you had the headmaster come in to take a class, everybody would absolutely dread it because he'd just come in and point at people and ask you to do the times table. And that was always a big challenge for me. So no, math was never my strong point. I was more involved in sort of like English. I really enjoyed English and I was quite sporty as well at school.
Okay, which sports?
Swimming and netball and short distance running.
Okay, and that would have worked socially as well, being in groups competing and stuff as
yes, I guess it did, yes. Mm. Yeah.
And tell me about the first boyfriend.
Oh, the first boyfriend. I don't know that I can remember that.
Oh, really?
Actually, no, I can tell you about my first boyfriend. My first boyfriend, and this is actually, this story kind of relates to where I am now in my life and the career I chose and the new direction that I'm going into now, trying to get into politics. So I was at a primary school in St Albans. It was a very middle class, all white primary school. And then unexpectedly, at the beginning of one of the terms, we had a Nigerian boy join our class, Peter Osimensa. Mm-hmm. And he was embraced very quickly by the class, made friends really quickly, and he became my first love. But what was, the story that relates to that was that another part-time teacher that we had who really didn't like children very much at all, and we then later discovered that she was also quite racist. She called Peter one day in class the N-word, and I was absolutely mortified and horrified by that and stormed out of the classroom into the headmaster's office and told on Miss Dawes for using that bad word to my friend. Yeah.
And the repercussions from that were?
Well, the headmaster was kind of shocked when he had this 9-year-old storming into his classroom with her hands on her hips and saying, Miss Dawes said, da, 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 and with the next, well, what are you going to do about it? And he kind of just sort of like took a backwards sort of step and said, oh, yeah, well, I'll speak to her, Naomi. Yes, that was really wrong. I'll speak to her. I don't know what actually happened. I mean, she certainly wasn't dismissed. She was around making everybody's lives miserable for many years after that. But
and yours especially, I would think.
Yes. Well, thankfully, we didn't have her very own. She was only a substitute, so we only got her if our main teacher was away. So,
okay. So you did your O levels or whatever, and you did.
I did my O levels, then I went on to do my A levels. Mm. I was a little bit of a rebel, I would say, and In between the first year and second year of doing A-levels, I went to Israel to do a spell on a kibbutz and really fell in love with Israel and kibbutz life. Mm. Didn't want to go back home to finish my A-levels, but was persuaded by everyone on the kibbutz that's you know what I should do. Yep. That would be the right thing to do. So I went back to school, and then after about 2 weeks, I thought, nah, this is not for me. Mm. And so I left school and then started looking for work and worked for a couple of years before I then went back and studied social work as a mature age student.
Okay.
I say mature age, but I was only 21, which is not really that mature, but that's what they called it.
So waitressing and that kind of stuff, or
I had a variety of jobs. I waitressed. I worked as a clerk in the gas and fuel company. That was absolute. Total, mind-numbing work.
Do your head in,
did my head. The best job I had during that whole period was driving an ice cream van. That was lot of fun.
Okay, yeah, and you're clearly becoming a little bit politically interested, if not active, at this time in your life.
Yes, I was. I mean, I was growing up in England at the time Margaret Thatcher was at the helm. Mm. And it was a very a very difficult and bitter time.
Especially in the Midlands.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Mm. There were a lot of strikes. We had the miners' strikes. Mm. We had bombings with the IRA. It really was really, you know, a difficult time to be in England. Actually, I remember when I was working as a social worker in a hostel for the homeless, and there was a lot of riots around. So it started with the Brixton riots and then just spread like wildfire around the country.
So the social work arrived as a natural thing that you found yourself interested in, or...?
Yes, look, it was. I think that I had, there were three things that I had thought that I would like to do when I grow up. Mm-hmm. And one of them was to do something that was, would help people, and I didn't know what form that would take. I also fancied myself a little bit as being a journalist, and I also wanted to be a vet.
Okay.
But being hopeless at maths and science kind of ruled that out of the equation fairly quickly.
Mm. But did you grow up with animals? Did you have?
Oh, yes. We grew up with a menagerie. So there was, we had a dog, and my mother used to breed cats. And so there was a whole lot of, various cats that she was breeding, as well as a motley crew of strays that she collected. We had chickens and guinea pigs and rabbits and ferret at one point. So.
Okay.
Oh, and chinchillas as well. At one time, we had chinchillas.
So it's a little eccentric around your house.
Yeah. Yes, somewhat. Somewhat.
What sort of young men were you drawn to then? Were revolutionary, similarly, sort of. Tell me about them.
Well. I don't know that I want to say too much about that. I was probably at a young age drawn to young men who a little bit on the edge, rode motorbikes, a little bit wild, non-conforming. That was,
So people that would startle the folks just a little bit.
That's right. Yeah. Shake them up a little bit.
Yeah. And shake you up a little bit too.
That's right.
So then you somehow found that you were interested in social work. That,
I started untrained as a residential care worker in a children's home, and this was a facility where children who were first being removed from their home were taken to this place for assessment whether they would. Go back home with support into foster care or to long-term childcare. Yep. So it was a transition place. And then from there, I went to work at a hostel for the single homeless. Then I went on to study social work.
Okay. And so this fulfilled this need to be of some use to people, to be of service?
Yeah, to make a difference in some way.
Did you find that stuff confronting initially? Was it?
I did find it confronting. I found it. I remember one incident when I was working at the hostel for the homeless, and so this was a hostel that took in from ages 6 to 25. And I was on duty one night, and I got a phone call saying that there would be two new. People arriving that night, a brother and a sister arriving at the hostel, and they turned up, and I opened the door to them, and it was two kids that I'd been to school with.
Oh, wow.
And that was, we both got a shock.
Yeah.
That was very confronting, and, I don't think really at the age that I was then that I had particularly the skills to be able to handle that very effectively. So yeah, there were lots of situations that were really quite confronting.
But confronting in a way that made you want to learn more about how to deal with that
absolutely,
and then study.
So
off to university.
Yes.
And working at the same time or full-time at university?
It was full-time at university, and the course that I did, half of it was at uni lectures, and the other half was actually in placements.
Okay, yeah. All right. So now you have your degree, and you're in the workplace still in the UK?
Well, actually, I left England pretty much as soon as I qualified.
Okay. And this was on the back of another relationship?
Well, funny you should mention that. Yes, it was. Yes, I followed a boyfriend to Australia. So it was love that brought me here. That love didn't last very long, but the love for the country did, and I stayed.
So he was an Aussie?
Yes, yeah. Yes, he was an Australian citizen.
Okay. And you came originally to Sydney, Melbourne?
To Melbourne.
To Melbourne,
yes.
All right. And developed an immediate affection for the place?
No, actually not an immediate affection for the place. It took me quite some time to really settle. I mean, the relationship, you know, we really tried to make it work, but, you know, after a couple of years, it's sort of like, you know, it fell apart. And so I was grappling with that as well as trying to establish myself in terms of a career and to make new friends. And it actually took me quite some time to really feel like I had settled and put down roots here.
So you were how old at this stage?
25.
25. And you didn't up sticks and go back to the UK because?
Because Margaret Thatcher was at the No, I could tell, like, even though it was, you know, it was difficult to settle and create a life for myself here, it was very apparent to me that this was a far better place to settle and to, you know, to create some kind of a life than going back to England. I didn't really see myself, even though, you know, I was missing, you know, friends there and all those sorts of familiar things. It felt right to just stay here and give it a go.
And part of that would have been the appeal of designing your own life and being completely free of the constraints of your accent or your upbringing and your family and all those things, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Mm. So, what did Katie do next?
Well, I had a couple of different jobs in the social work arena. And then I went into private practice. And I thought that when I went into private, with another woman. And we imagined that what we were going to be developing was a nice sort of counselling, stress management type practice, but that's not what actually then evolved. We found ourselves very soon in the thick of working with people with severe histories of trauma and abuse. And so the practice kind of developed organically with people who were coming through the door. And once we got known to be working with this particular client group, then of course we started to get referrals, you know, specifically to work with these clients. And then from there, we developed a training and development side of the practice where we put on conferences and workshops, brought people from overseas who specialise in trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder and dissociative disorders.
So you found a partner with a similar interest in this area. You were working with someone else?
Yes, my business partner.
So how did you discover each other? How did that partnership begin?
Oh, now that's a good question. That's going back so many years. I can't remember. I think it was through some kind of a social connection was the first the first way that we met, and then sort of like developed a friendship. And she had already. She was a speech pathologist and had already left speech pathology and was sort of like out on her own. And then she invited me to join her in the practice, and that's where the Delphi Centre sort of like grew from there.
So it was obviously a remarkably creative and productive relationship that...
Look, it has been. We have very complementary skills, and so it has been a really good working partnership over many years. yeah, we, I think that neither of us sort of like had in our minds a plan of we were going to do this, that and the other. As I said before, it really just evolved over time and really quite organically responding to the needs that, you know, we saw as they arose.
So there was no business plan as such. It was a matter of doing the things that you really...
That's right.
..that you really like to do.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
I was often given that advice. So, and that's still going, or that... how long did that go? And
what yes, is, yeah. yes. Well, that yes. So the business is still going. I closed the counselling side of my practice at the end of 2011. So I've been on the coal face, as it were, for 25 years, and decided that that was really enough for me, and I wanted to focus more on developing the consulting and the training side of the business. So that's really what I've been doing over the last 4.5 years.
Okay, and in the 25 years that you were doing the consulting work, doing the counselling work, how did you debrief? Did you have a therapist? Did you have someone that a place and a mechanism by which you could unburden?
Yes, look, over that long period of time, there were a whole range of different things that I would do to support myself around the work that I was doing. So having my own therapy was part of that. My business partner and I would also, share and debrief with each other about particular cases. But we also had a very strong peer group around us of people who are working in the same area too, that we could talk to and support each other as well.
Is there a single thing that kept you sane? I mean, you were exposed, obviously, to a lot of pretty rugged human behaviour.
Yeah.
Is there a faith, a belief, a philosophy, an activity that you found that really was useful?
Well, buying my place down here was a big part of my self-care package. I grew, as you know, I said before, I grew up in the country, in the UK. And when I first arrived in Australia, some friends brought me down the Great Ocean Road and we ended up in Apollo Bay. And I fell in love with the place from the moment I saw it. And had a fantasy I would love to, live down here. But that didn't seem realistic because my work kept me in the city. But then when I did scrape together the money for a deposit for a house, and I thought about it, and I thought, I don't actually want to buy Melbourne. I want to buy down in Apollo Bay. And I know that didn't make economic sense or any of that, but this is where I wanted to put down roots. And so I would come down every weekend and on holidays. And that was, that's how I think I kept myself grounded and, and sane, relatively speaking.
yes. It's a relative space, isn't it? Sanity. And your personal life during this time, did work consume a lot of your life?
It did actually. It did consume a lot of my life through, my late 20s and through my 30s. And it did take some time to really get that balance right of, how much I wanted to put into my work and how much I, time I needed for my own interests and downtime. And I think that, but I think the thing is that if you've got something that you feel passionate about, and really committed to, it's different to if you're doing a job to to pay the bills and your hobbies and interests are outside of your work. So I think that's but it's there's also a cost to that as well.
So it's a vocation.
A vocation. Yeah.
So does that mean that you occasionally feel a bit lonely and isolated, or?
Actually, no.
No.
I would say that I'm probably a little bit of a hermit. I'm very social and I enjoy being with friends and family, but I'm also very happy to retreat up into the hills and just spend time quietly up in the hills with my dog.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And so there you are up in the hills and you're kind of moving out of the coalface of providing hands-on therapy and consulting and teaching, and then imagining a life more centred here? Is that how it's
Yes,
going?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. And you had some fun and games with trees, I understand.
With trees?
Hmm.
I don't know what fun and game with trees. Oh, those trees. I'm thinking about trees sort of like along Killala Road. I'm thinking, yeah, well, they are a bit of a problem. I need to speak to the council about that. Yes, that wasn't so much fun and games. Yes, I was one of many, many people who were caught up in a whole range of failed agribusiness projects, specifically trees. TimberCorp was the one that has really hit the headlines, but there were several other projects that all went down the proverbial sink.
So do you think that happened because of bad management, or do you think it was probably not a sound idea and that it was being marketed by people who really were just interested in short-term gain? What I mean, with a bit of hindsight?
I think, well, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that...
Just wish you had it at the time.
That's right. I think that these projects were doomed to fail from the outset now that I have had many years to look into you know, what happened and how it all unfolded, that they were never going to work. They were sold to me and to, you know, many other people, just sort of like, you know, normal mum and dad investors, as being superior products to superannuation. It would be a long-term investment. By the time I reached the age that I am now, that they would, you know, beginning to be harvest. You could reinvest the money, or, you know, the whole sort of like spiel. And of course, that turned out to be absolute rubbish, and ended up losing a lot of money.
So that was a fairly painful and difficult time?
It has been, you know, painful and difficult, I think, is putting it mildly. It was hugely traumatic. You know, you go through life and think that you're doing the right thing. You seek out, you know, help from a financial advisor because you don't understand about investing and you want to take responsibility for your future, and then to find out that you have essentially been completely done over, and you know, it wasn't accidental. There was some very deliberate and calculated manoeuvring and deceitful ways that things were presented, and all of a sudden the rug is completely pulled out from underneath you, and you know, you find that not only have you lost security for some kind of a future that you imagined that you were going to have, but have been left in tremendous debt that will take, you know, forever to get out of. And you know, I'm not the only person. There's been literally hundreds and hundreds of people through this particular accountant and financial advisor, but across Australia, people who have really fallen foul of these tree schemes.
So when that penny dropped, whose arms did you fall into?
You know, there wasn't time to fall into anybody's arms. It was about survival. You know, I remember this. So this was back in the it all fell apart in 2008, at the end of 2008. And of course, my financial advisor accountant was blaming it on the GFC. It was not the GFC. The GFC exposed what he was doing, but it wasn't the cause of what happened to me and many other people. I was so busy trying to keep my head above water that there was no time to fall into, you know, on anyone's shoulder to get comfort and support. It was just survival.
Okay.
And that went on for several years.
And by which time?
And of course, I'm still actually dealing with the fallout of this now. It's not over.
It's a lifelong thing. Family, do you stay in touch?
Yes. Yeah. So I have a brother in Queensland, far north Queensland. He's actually in his car as we speak, on his way down. He's going to visit me, so he'll be here in a week or so. He's on a bit of a road trip. And I've got a sister in Perth. And my niece and nephew, who are my brother's children, my nephew lives in Brisbane, and my niece lives up in Noosa, Toowoomba area.
Okay, and you've been to Queensland a few times, I imagine.
Oh yes, yeah. My niece got married last October, and up on the beach in Noosa, so that was a lot of fun.
And you're not drawn by the warmth and slowness of the north?
No, I complain a lot about the cold down here, but I couldn't live in that kind of humidity and heat. So I actually like the change of seasons that we have down here.
Okay. And so how did this political thing begin?
The political, I'm sort of found myself as actually being kind of like an accidental Senate candidate. It was not on my bucket list, must run for the Senate before I die. It really has come out of the work that I've been doing with the Action Group for, you know, trying to seek justice around the financial services and everything. So I became the spokesperson for the Action Group, and we started to get a lot of media in mid-2014. We were lobbying parliamentarians. I was involved in a few Senate hearings. And through that exposure, meeting various parliamentarians and seeing the opportunity of what can potentially be done to change this mess of a financial services industry that we have, it began to sort of like draw me into that political realm. And I met obviously a number of politicians, but Nick Xenophon just stood head and shoulders above the rest as far as I was concerned. And so I've been just sort of like thinking, oh, maybe I should, you know, think about going into politics, and, you know, maybe I could run as an independent, and thinking, oh, no, that just seems too difficult at my age. And then Nick announced that he was starting his own party, and that's when the kind of stars aligned, and I threw my hat in the ring.
Okay. And so far it's a hat in the ring, isn't it?
That's right, yes.
So the bells and whistles haven't begun yet. Life for you, and how much time do you actually spend in Apollo Bay now these days?
Well, that's a good question. When I moved down here full time at the end of 2011, I imagined that I was going to be having a far quieter, peaceful life. But I've actually found that I'm on the road an awful lot with my work, because I still do a lot of training interstate and go up to Melbourne to do face-to-face consulting. Yep. So I do a lot by Skype, but a lot of it's face-to-face as well. And of course, since I've been involved in the Action Group and now campaigning, I'm sort of coming and going all the time. It's always a relief to get home, though.
It is. It is the price that we all pay for living here.
Yes.
It's that little. It's a minor tyranny of distance, but it is a tyranny. That's for sure. And so, if you're successful in the Senate, you'll see far less of Apollo Bay.
Yes, I know. I'm aware of that, and I've kind of bracing myself for that possibility. But I do feel so passionate and committed about what I'm, you know, embarking on now. I think, well, you know, again, that's sort of like a price that I'm prepared to pay if I can get across the line and be a representative for Victoria in Canberra. Then I think that that's, you know, it's worth. It's worth it. It's worth the upheaval and the time away from home.
So the drive to help people and be of service to your community, and where do you think that comes from? Was it something that was evident in your family of origin? Is it Is there some?
No, it wasn't evident in the sense of parents being very active in the community or involved in helping professions. I think that maybe in part it has something to do with my father being a Holocaust survivor and growing up in the shadow of the Holocaust.
Sure.
So it was the elephant in the room growing up.
Yeah.
And not something that I could even really articulate until I was in my mid-30s. But I think that that probably shaped a lot of the person that, you know, I am and my concerns about justice and, you know, the welfare of others.
And the kibbutz would have made a contribution because you were at that very impressionable
age.
Yes,
absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
Do you ever have a feeling or a wish to live in a kibbutz, to live in a community like that?
When I was a teenager, so I had two stints on the kibbutz. I did the first one when I was in the summer holidays doing my A-levels, and then the following summer I went back and I spent about 7 months in Israel then, some of the time on a kibbutz and some other time on a moshav. And I think that it's that's a very fun experience for a teenager or someone in their early 20s to go through. But the actual lifestyle of a kibbutz, I think I would have found very claustrophobic if I had stayed there. And I've been back to Israel a few times since then. And of course, the whole kibbutz system is very different now. It's a whole different ball game now. So.
Well, good luck with the Senate.
Thank you.
So you'll be doing the whole thing, the hustings, and you know, knocking on people's doors and handing out
absolutely
pamphlets and all
absolutely
of that stuff.
Stop me in the street and ask me a question.
And thank you very much for talking to us on What's Your Story.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is 3ABR, a program called What's Your Story, and we've been talking to Naomi Halpern.